So we're just a week away from Election Day, and the predictions are flying all over the place. Conventional wisdom has always had it that being an incumbent is a major asset for a candidate, but the reality this year might be a bit more complicated. On today's installment of our election series, The Big Picture, we will be talking about incumbency. And joining me now is Nate Silver, author of the 538 blog for the New York Times. We've linked to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Nate, welcome to our show.
Yeah, thank you, Leonard.
The most commonly thrown around phrase this election cycle has been that it's an anti-incumbent year. Is that just a general mood? How is it playing out in races that would have been easy wins for incumbents in the past?
Well, you know, usually being an incumbent is worth about a 7-point bonus when you go from being running in an open seat where there's no incumbent to being the incumbent the next time around. You gain about 7 points just based on being able to fundraise more easily and having more name recognition. But, you know, this year a lot of incumbents are going to lose, in the House especially. We think probably about 40 Democratic incumbents are probably going to lose, maybe a couple of Republicans as well. But, you know, when the economy is as troubled as it's been, our country's kind of working through the challenges it has, you don't want to be kind of the one holding the ball sometimes and being the one who has to be accountable for everything.
But in other times of crisis, haven't voters been uneasy about changing horses in midstream? I remember during the reelection campaign for George Bush, many people said that they were unhappy with some of the things he had done, but they felt that it wasn't the right time to change leaders.
Well, you know, I think in terms of foreign policy crises, that might be true, and it might also be true of the presidency. You know, I think you could have Obama make an argument in 2012 that, hey, you know, reelect me. The country has too many problems for someone who's inexperienced, kind of flipping around, I guess, the wisdom that was used against him in 2008, you know. And I think if Obama endures heavy losses in the Congress, which seems likely, he might be easier to reelect in 2012. He'll be divided government instead of kind of a Democratic sweep, I suppose. But, you know, it seems like the economy people do place blame on the people in Washington. You know, I almost think that's the wrong way around, right, where maybe the government has less control over the economy and more control over foreign policy, right? But, you know, that's not the way the typical voter sees it, and Democrats have, I think, had trouble articulating a message. There are also a few Republican incumbents who could lose, probably not any in the Senate, but, you know, there will be a few in the House, it looks like. But, you know, one thing to remember, too, is that Democrats are kind of at a close to a high watermark, where there are only so many Senate seats, certainly so many House seats, when so many districts are gerrymandered and just really partisan, that can even plausibly go to one party or another. And Democrats won kind of almost all of those in 2006 and 2008. So in some ways, we can't really differentiate an anti-incumbent year from an anti-Democratic year, because Democrats are the incumbents almost everywhere where you might have a close election in the first place.
Are many of those vulnerable candidates the so-called blue dog Democrats who won traditionally Republican seats in the past?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are different kind of categories of blue dogs. You know, there are some who kind of like that label because it makes them seem more moderate, but tend to kind of vote with the party on most issues anyway. There are others who really are, you know, kind of Democrats in name only, in the phrase. You know, there are some who come from districts where, you know, a lot of kind of traditional kind of Southern Democrats were wiped out in 1994, for example. You know, but there still are a few who kind of, you know, Gene Taylor down in Mississippi is one, and a really Republican district where he just kind of won re-election every year. And all those Democrats are being put to the test, with a handful of exceptions. But especially in the South, the kind of few who survived the kind of realignment in the South are under a lot of scrutiny from voters this year.
Many people keep on referring back to the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994. Is the political situation right now all that similar to what it was 16 years ago? I mean, this time the Democrats passed health care. I don't know whether that was a positive or a negative in the voters' minds.
Now, you know, I think the result could turn out to be quite similar, where I think the most prudent projection now is that Republicans will gain 50 seats, maybe up to 52 or so in the House, and that would be very similar to 94. You know, I think the reasons are different, where in 94, both the Democratic and the Republican parties were more popular than they were now. Republicans had pretty good ratings. You know, this year is more like, well, we don't like either choice, and we're going to vote for the guys who aren't in power, and those happen to be Republicans in most competitive cases. So, you know, 1994 maybe wasn't as much of an anti-Democratic year as kind of, you know, as a pro-Republican year, I suppose. This year it's just like, well, people, you know, are going to default to the guy who you know, whose turn it wasn't this current time, and, you know, just kind of switch up and hope for the best.
How long did incumbency favor the Republicans who were swept into office in 1994?
Well, I mean, they held the, you know, they did badly in the presidential race in 1996, you know, but they held the House for quite a long time until 2006. They held the Senate until Jim Jeffords defected in Vermont in 2000, then won it back. You know, I think this year, so here's the kind of Achilles heel for Republicans, right, who will probably have a great night on November 2nd. Whereas if they're elected and their party approval ratings, their party brand remains damaged, which it does, and they're going to have trouble passing anything just as Democrats would have in a Congress that's about evenly divided, then you could have the backlash in 2012 or 2014. So you kind of could have this whipsaw effect. And frankly, I think until we do have kind of, you know, unemployment back down to some reasonable level and the country feeling like we have a little bit more control over, you know, the kind of long-term fiscal stability of the country, you're going to have, you know, a lot of incumbents lose the next, you know, couple of political cycles. And if Republicans have a great year this year, that makes them more of a target in 2012, 2014.
But you're saying that in many cases, people will be voting against rather than for. In the polling, is a generic Republican faring better than a generic Democrat?
That's right. Yeah, when you know, a lot of polls will test, hey, if there were a Democrat and a Republican running for Congress in your district, who would you vote for? And right now, generic Republican seems to lead that question by about 7 points on average. Some polls have it less, some polls have it more. But, you know, that would correspond to a gain that would be pretty large. That might be 50 or 60 or even 65 seats. You know, in some cases, the local polls, the state-by-state and district-by-district polls are a little bit better for Democrats, but they're not a lot better. And I think, you know, unless the polls are kind of wrong in one direction or another, and they can be. In 1998, for example, there was supposed to be a kind of mini Republican wave year, and it turned out they did quite poorly at the midterms. So you have had years where the polls just kind of miss the mood of the electorate. But unless that occurs, Democrats are running out of room to preserve their majority in the House, I would think.
In some of the more prominent races, like the ones involving Christine O'Donnell, Joe Miller, Sharon Angle, Carl Palladino, the candidates are far from generic Republicans.
Well, look, I mean, and some of those candidates are underperforming, where, you know, Harry Reid's approval ratings are about 40%, right, in a year like this one, which is, you know, not when you have a very Democratic or Republican turnout, right, kind of a swing state, he should be losing by 10 points, you know. Or in Colorado, you have Ken Buck, who's a pretty conservative candidate, has made some gaffes, and that race is now tied. He should probably be winning that race if he were kind of a generic Republican. But, you know, you also have some problematic Democratic candidates. You know, Alexei Janulius in Illinois is a little bit young and had some problems with his former employment in the banking sector. You know, that's a state where even in a bad Democratic year, they should probably win, you know. So I think it kind of cuts both ways a little bit. You have some strong Republican candidates, too, like, you know, say Rob Portman in Ohio, very kind of suit and tie and kind of dull, I suppose. And he's going to win his race by 15 or 20 points. You know, Marco Rubio in Florida is a guy who was considered a Tea Partier, but, you know, it looks like he might run away with that race, which is a three-way race against Kendrick Meek and Charlie Crist. So it is kind of more a case-by-case basis. I think sometimes there's too much focus on the kind of Christine O'Donnells and Carl Palladinos, and it distracts from the fact that, you know, A, Democrats are going to have a bad night, and B, you know, the candidate quality issues are a little bit more ambiguous than it might seem from looking at kind of these outlier examples.
Well, I asked Gail Collins earlier about whether it's better for the scandal to come out early in the race rather than later in the race, and that seems to have been a factor in these races.
You know,
can only wonder what's going to come up in the next week.
You know, Rand Paul, for example, is a guy who took a lot of scrutiny early on in the campaign, and, you know, he had done some kind of crazy things in college and kind of deflected it. You know, their primary was pretty early this year. And when Jack Conway, the Democrat, tried to bring it back up, it looked like it more or less didn't help and may have hurt him a little bit. Whereas someone like a Ken Buck in Colorado, where these things are being said kind of in the present tense and in real time, then, you know, that might be a little bit more difficult. So some candidates who, you know, like Marco Rubio, for example, who, you know, a Tea Partier, but also someone who's pretty moderate in terms of how he presents himself to the world, pretty telegenic, too, you know, he hasn't had so many problems. But, you know, it's kind of a moving target in a lot of races, and, you know, the Republicans will lose some seats, you know, both in the House and the Senate because of who they picked, but, you know, they've also, in general, had a, you know, they've gotten competitive recruits in a tremendous number of Senate seats and districts, and that's harder to do than it might seem. Just have someone who's even kind of competent to run for office doesn't always happen, and they do have that in most places.
My guess is Nate Silver, who writes the 5:30, what is it, 8 or even 8?
5:38.
5:38 yeah. Blog for the New York Times. He's talking to us as part of our The Big Picture series. Today we're talking about incumbency. In some places like California, aren't incumbents doing better than had been expected?
Well, it looks like the West Coast is the one region where Democrats might do fairly well and potentially save the Senate in the process, where, you know, it looks like, Patty Murray is favored to win in Washington. It looks like Barbara Boxer will more likely than not pull it out in California. But in some ways, the dynamics are a little different in each state. In the governor's race in California, for example, you know, kind of Meg Whitman, so you have Jerry Brown, a former governor, right? But you also have the current governor of California is a Republican, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Meg Whitman has spent so much money that she almost seems like maybe not an incumbent, but someone who's kind of, you know, not an underdog, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I think she's kind of faded as maybe she's kind of saturated the airwaves with commercials and voters are starting to tune her out. So, you know, California looks good for Democrats, but, you know, in Washington State and Oregon, they'll win the Senate race there. But, you know, it's three states out of 50, and it might be enough to save the Senate because Republicans have to sweep pretty much everything. But it doesn't, I think, do too much to kind of contradict the overall trend this year.
Now, why isn't that happening in New York State, where the two incumbent senators, Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, look like shoo-ins? Is it because the Republicans just didn't put up strong candidates to fight them? New York has elected Republican senators in the past.
So this is a great mystery, I think. Why did Republicans nominate such a weak set of candidates in New York State, when this is the state of Thomas Dewey and the state of, you know, Rockefeller and Jacob Javits and all these kind of moderate Republicans, right?
It's where and New a York lot of unemployment in the state.
Yeah, you know, and Gillibrand is someone who was appointed as a senator, not elected last time, and, you know, she would seem to have been very vulnerable, but for some reason, I mean, they really put up a horrible, frankly, slate of candidates. I mean, I think they would not have beat Chuck Schumer. You know, he's a guy who, look, for him, the anti-incumbent wave might mean he wins by 40 points instead of 50, right? There's still an effect, but not enough to make the race close, you know. But Gillibrand, you would think, could have been vulnerable. You know, Cuomo is hard to say. You know, he, I think sometimes, you know, kind of projected too much of an air of inevitability and arrogance, but in the end, he'll probably win his race quite easily and would probably be kind of a generic. I think he'd probably beat like a Rick Lazio type Republican too, but if they had some of the candidates they've had in the past, then, you know, it could be competitive, certainly, and I don't know what's happened to the state party here, frankly.
There's an article in the New York Times recently about how Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who lost her primary battle against Joe Miller, may be reelected as the first write-in candidate to the Senate since Strom Thurmond in 1954.
Well, you know, this is a
do they have to spell her name correctly?
They actually don't, as long as it's voter intent, right, which is going to get messy. I mean, one thing about this race in Alaska is that, you know, Joe Miller's run a very unappealing campaign and maybe will motivate people to kind of go through that extra step and fill in the oval and try to spell her name correctly. But, you know, what might happen is if it's within a couple of points in Alaska, you're going to have a legal morass, kind of what you saw in Minnesota with the recount there. It might be that kind of times 10, pretty much, you know, because every ballot, every kind of cursive handwriting, every voter who kind of fills in the oval but, you know, just says Lisa, or who doesn't fill in the oval but spells her name perfectly, you know, all those ballots will be debated. And there could be, you know, relative to Alaska, that could be, you know, 5 or 10% of the votes could be in this category where it's like, well, yeah, we think you meant to vote for Murkowski, but it's kind of an imperfectly done ballot, and that will get really, really messy, I think. But the fact that Joe Miller has, you know, has been a little arrogant, frankly, and kind of saying, oh, Lisa's entitled, and, you know, it almost makes him seem as though, you know, he's kind of putting the, you know, kind of cutting the drapes for his new office and so on and so forth. And I think that has opened up the fact that, you know, Murkowski could win, and maybe the Democrat Scott McAdams, and everything breaks perfectly, could sneak in with 35% of the vote as well.
Although it's interesting that the Democrat is not even being discussed in this race.
Well, I think if you asked him, he'd probably say that's not such a bad thing. I can kind of fly below the radar. A lot of national Democrats are excited about this race. I mean, the problem is there aren't very many Democrats in Alaska, of course. But, you know, if he can get every Democrat in the state to kind of turn out for him and win a few independents who are sick of kind of the Murkowski-Miller feud, then he probably can get up to 35% of the vote. In a three-way race, you can win with anything more than a third of the vote. So he has a shot, we think. He's not, you know, he's a definite underdog, but, you know, I don't think he necessarily wants to be getting a ton of attention, and, you know, because Democrats aren't very popular in a cycle like this in Alaska, but if he's simply the nice guy, right, and the most acceptable choice and the least annoying candidate, frankly, then, you know, then he can maybe do well enough to sneak out with a win.
How much of an impact do you think the Citizens United ruling, which lifted caps on political donations, is going to have on this election cycle?
I think we're not going to have a good answer to that question until until after the election. I mean, you know, fundraising certainly matters. It matters mostly, I think, in kind of getting candidates on the board and getting their kind of name recognition up to being near universal in the state or the district. I think at some point, you know, maybe you're Meg Whitman in California, you hit diminishing returns. But, you know, Republicans are playing a very, very large map this year where there are, you know, literally probably 100, maybe even 105, 110 competitive House districts. There are, you know, 15 Senate seats that are competitive. Almost every governor's race is competitive to some or another extent, you know. And it takes a lot of money to do that. They are getting plenty of contributions from individual Republicans, the traditional way. It seems to help at the margins, though, also to have these kind of outside groups contributing money. And maybe, you know, I think it'll probably win them, you know, since the money does seem to be mostly Republican, these, you know, some of these outside groups. It might win them, I think, an extra 3 or 4 seats, say, in the House, places where the candidates' fundraising was not strong, but where they can take a shot on a few more races that they otherwise might have had to you know, cut out, you know, because candidates seem like too much of a long shot. If someone's down 5 or 10 points in the polls, they're not going to be your primary target, right? But, you know, but that might change if you have an extra set of kind of resources to work with.
Although that can also backfire. In California, the World Series seems to have added to the anti-Texas sentiment in regard to the Proposition 23 vote, where a lot of money is coming from Texas from oil companies. So people recognize that. Just one more thing. Democrats have had a number of major policy victories, from health care to Wall Street reform, major investments in green energy. But many of the candidates are running away from their party. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they looked at the polling early on and said, oh, you know, voters are unhappy. And, you know, the health care bill in most surveys did not kind of poll well, but part of it's because Democrats didn't do a good job of explaining it in the first place, where if you ask questions about the individual elements of the health care bill, then a lot of it's actually kind of popular. You know, if you kind of read a description of what the bill actually did instead of what people thought it did, the bill actually polls reasonably well. But still, you know, the phrase kind of Obamacare is a loaded one, and you use that phrase, and a lot of voters, especially independents, have a negative reaction to it. Republicans know that. I mean, you know, I think we could step back on November 3rd and say, look, you know, Democrats needed to, you know, a year ago kind of think this through a little bit better in terms of how their messaging was. You know, but at some point it kind of became they went down one path where they're like, well, we're going to kind of try and localize these elections, let everyone be a free agent, run against the Obama agenda if it suits them, you know, and mostly kind of make a big mess of things and try and demean the Republican candidate, you know. Is that the best choice? I don't know. You know, they'll probably save a few seats that way. If they had had a more kind of coherent narrative, would it be better? Maybe. Would it be worse? Because people are like, well, we don't like health care. We don't like the deficits you're running up. Maybe it would be worse. I don't know. You know, but my hunch, my intuition is that they could have been more thoughtful about kind of how, you know, voters are going to forget about the health care bill, and to have a more positive pitch, you know, based around it. And a few candidates, too, you know, might have been more fruitful in the long run.
Well, we'll find out what really is the case next week. And my great thanks to Nate Silver, author of the 538 blog for the New York Times. We've been talking about incumbency as part of our The Big Picture series on the show. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Leonard.